Hey, everybody. Welcome again to another episode. It's the Shop Notes Podcast with Phil, John, and Logan. Today is episode number 186. On today's episode, we're going to be discussing dust collection and strategies therein. We'll also be talking about pricing your work when you're not a pro. And we're also going to give a little update on some TV show projects that we're working on and some of the challenges that you'll find in building projects. A little word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Titebond. You want a glue that you can trust, and fortunately, Titebond has the glue you need to get the job done with confidence. From interior glues with strong initial tack and short clamp time to exterior glues with exceptional strength and water resistance, look to Titebond, the right glue for your next project. For more information, visit tightbond.com. All right. Few comments from the last podcast, just to get things started here. Linda Payne, 2134, says, your discussion of turning a plumb bob reminded me that my sister gave me a Veritas plumb bob kit, which she purchased from Lee Valley around 1998, way back in the 1900s.
Mm-hmm. Turn of the century.
Yeah. A very quick search of my shop, which must be better organized than Logan's, I found it on the shelf above my lathe. I can't include a picture of the parts, but there is a mandrel to hold the piece of wood and insert into the lathe, a threaded rod about 1 3/8 long to insert the turned bob, and a brass top and tip. There's even an 8-foot piece of fine nylon cord, which I don't remember. Don't remember that kit, but there you go. First and last, 4779 says about the hackberry. He made a picture frame of spalted hackberry, and it finished pretty nice. Have some length seasoning. Kind of interested to see how it looked. So I followed up with him and asked if he had a, you know, how was it cut? And he said it was flat sawn, about 3/4 inch thick, just surprisingly straight. So then he said he had to smile about not harvesting from your 5-acre wood because storms have harvested a 35-inch oak and a 20-inch cherry in my 1-acre woods recently.
Yes.
Yeah. Some of the best, some of the best tree felling is done by storms.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then one that I think is interesting for us to address is Chuck Frayne writes, I know most of your friends over at Fine Woodworking have Instagram accounts under their own handles. Do you guys post only under the Woodsmith Mag identifier or Popwood? And if you have your own accounts, can you list them somewhere?
Mm. I think they're more popular than we are.
Yeah, they're personal. I think that comes from a long, like, Woodsmith was always just anonymous.
Right.
We were just like one person, and that was kind of, I don't want to say beaten into us, but beaten into us.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
We were assimilated, I think, is really what you were trying to get at there.
Yes.
So, one voice. No, most of us do not have our own Instagram accounts. Do we post on the Popwood and Woodsmith Instagram accounts sometimes?
Yeah.
When we think about it, you know,
I've been.
You Phil's have. Yeah, Phil has been lately. I think the one thing that the guys at Fine have done really well is they've branded themselves pretty well. So, you know, I mean, you know, a Mike Pekovich piece because it's Mike, right? But as John said, the Woodsmith thing was always a one voice type thing. So it was always, you know, you never really seen the people behind the scenes. Now, obviously that's changed the last several years and we all definitely have our own styles. So, you know, should we? Yeah, probably.
And I think part of that is a lot of the other magazines are outsourced design and build projects. So it's, you know, their personal projects as well, where a lot of this stuff here is done internally. So it's just like
it's a group kind of, effort.
On the Woodsmith name. Yeah. Cause it's, you got one designer, an editor, a builder are all part of the project. So it's hard to really take personal account on any one thing, but
Yep.
Yeah, something to think about.
Yeah. All right, so Logan, I know that you've been going through the plumbing process of dust collection at your shop.
Oh, yes, I have.
And then related to that, in the shop here, we were building a new workstation for our benchtop drill press.
Yep.
And both of those topics kind of intersect because while we were in the process of making that, you were working on your dust collection system and had brought up the question of, do you run dust collection to the drill press area?
Yeah. Yeah. Because so yes, I am installing a new dust collector system in the shop here. It's installed. I've been working on the plumbing, the hard line fittings, which if anybody's ever bought it, that stuff is not cheap. It is pricey. And the real kick in the old shorts is that you order all these parts and then you have to order like three more times because you don't have the right parts. It's like going to the hardware store, but you can't just go to the hardware store.
Right.
But what I had brought this up to Phil because, so I'm working with Oneida to do this. So I bought the dust collector and the system from Oneida. They did a shop layout for me. So that's one of the services they offer is like you say, hey, here's my shop plan. Here's where my tools are. And they designed the dust collection system, like, you know, where everything was, basically the roadmap, the plans on putting everything together. And when I had started this process with them back probably in the fall, maybe late summer, I had an idea where stuff was going to go. Now stuff has kind of shifted and moved a little bit. So stuff's in a little bit different spot than I had planned, which means that when I ordered $9,000 worth of dust collection parts, I didn't have necessarily all the right parts and I had a lot of extra parts for some other sizes. So as I was laying stuff out, I kind of questioned, do I really run? So the dust collector's in one corner. The furthest run is in the opposite corner, which happens to be where my drill press is going to go. And I had asked Phil, you know, what are your thoughts? Like, should I truly run a 6-inch line all the way over there? Because dust collection at the drill press is kind of sketchy. Like, what are you really collecting? It's one of those things like you almost have to have a little arm that you put right where the drill bit is every time to get it to suck stuff up.
And even then, I don't think it's necessarily, unless you're really moving a lot of air.
Yes.
I don't know that it's even that effective.
Yeah, which I will say, so I've spent this morning before we're recording this podcast prepping material for a presentation I'm doing now at the St. Louis Woodworkers Guild this weekend. And so I've prepped a lot of cherry today. And this new system, I don't have everything sealed up all the way yet. So like as you're putting joints together, you're using foil tape around those seams. And then like all of the elbows and the blast gates, you actually use like an RTV caulk around. I haven't done any of that. So I know I'm probably like 80% efficient right now. It's so nice. There's so much air moving. Oh my gosh. It's like, this is how this should be, like running stuff through the planer. Nothing's coming out other than clean wood on the backside. Okay. The table saw is pretty decent. I mean, you know, without an overarm, which those are stupid anyways. Okay. I'm not, you know, you're not going to get everything, but it's pretty good. But so I think that this system probably has the air movement to draw from. That would be a 6-inch line over and then down. And then from the 6-inch, it would neck down to like, I think a 4-inch for that. It's one of those things. It's like, I'm probably going to run it because I have the parts. Like I could ship them back and return them for like a 75% restocking fee or 25% restocking fee. So like it's, I don't know. To me, I have the parts. I might as well just run it. I think the more valuable thing is, and it's funny because I was talking to Mark in the shop about this because he installed a few of them. And we had one in the past, and I don't know what happened to it. I got a couple of the floor sweeps from Oneida. Those things are freaking fantastic.
Yeah, we used to. There were actually three at one point in the show. Yeah.
And I mean, so they're just you have a Y that comes down. One, the branch is going to the tool. Then the straight down one is going to a little, vent basically that you can sweep stuff into, and it just sucks it up. It's kind of like going to the credit union and you put a little tube in and it shoots it up. So I think when I reordered parts the other day, when I realized I was missing a few, I added an additional floor sweep based on Phil's suggestion, because you had said, maybe you just have a floor sweep there, because you kind of just blow off the drill press and then you sweep it all up. So that's what I'm going to do. I am going to put a Y there just so I have it.
Right.
I guess. I just don't believe that a drill press dust collection works well unless you're doing something like, I think if you're like using a drum sander in the drill press, then you probably, probably want something. I mean, I know, and we've designed drill press fences with dust collection in them. They just don't ever seem to work real well.
Well, a lot of it is, I feel like a drill press, there are several tools in the shop that I think people have a tendency, at least in my own observation around here and my own personal work habits, where you just kind of go over to the tool, turn it on, do something, and then walk away from it.
Yeah.
And a drill press is one of those. Like a miter saw is another one, and probably the bandsaw in the way that most people would use them. Mm-hmm. So it's harder to think about drill, setting, because if you're going to set up for dust collection at the drill press, then that's a whole separate step than just turning it on and turning it off.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a little bit more going on. Not that you can't do it, but it's just, that's just a lot more.
Yeah. Now I will say the one thing that I am, anybody that has a truly like set up permanent type shop, whether it's in your garage or, a separate shop, that has a hard-lined dust collection system. I having worked with this for the last, I've really only had it hooked up for like a week now. I'm trying to, much like in Woodsmith, it was beat into us to have one voice. I'm trying to beat it into myself to make sure when I shut a tool off, I shut the blast gate.
Oh yeah.
Because I mean, how many times are we in the shop back, in the office where it's like, turn the dust collection on, and I'm like, man, this thing is not sucking. You walk around, it's because there's literally 40 blast gates open. So you walk around, you shut them all. It's like whack-a-mole, just shutting them all.
Yep.
So I've been trying to do myself a solid, and tool shuts off, blast gate shuts off.
Right.
And it is a little different from a... This dust collector, this is their Gorilla. It's a 5-horse system. It takes a long time to wind up. So like when you turn on, it takes probably 30 seconds to get to top speed.
Okay.
So I was thinking initially that, I would get this big expense out of the way with, the dust collector setup, the blast gate, or, the dust collector setup, the ductwork stuff. And then down the road, I would add like the IVAC blast gates where you turn a tool on, the dust collector turns on.
Right.
But this is such a slow startup that it's like, I would, you get into work mode. It's like you turn a tool on, you shut it off.
Right.
In that amount of time, I would probably, the dust collector wouldn't even spool to top speed. So I don't know that I will go that far.
Yeah. But I mean, there's a little bit of a strategy. Cause I mean, when you're, and we're seeing that in our own shop as Mark is revamping the system, that, I mean, you want to have dust collection set up effectively to all the tools that you want to have it set up for, but a bunch of rarely used branch lines are just vampires on performance.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Rather than being actually all that helpful, you know, which is where we were going in that conversation about the drill press, is like, what's the point of having a branch that goes over to the drill press that is sitting around doing nothing most of the time, unlike, say, a planer or a table saw or something like that.
John has one lined up. I'm waiting for him to say it. It has something to do with the vampire and sucking. Yep. I know. Yep. I know.
No, I was going to say that it's funny that Vampires on Performance was my high school's goth rock garage band. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. So, okay. I remember that.
I can just see.
You see it spilling over here.
Oh, it's like man, it's like you have to let it get released.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. No, and I get that, and that's, I think, to me, that's one of the things, like, I'm trying to do this once, and I'm trying to avoid all those, like, deadheads, because right. they do. So anytime you have a deadhead, or anytime you have branches that aren't getting used, like, they absolutely rob the system. And that's, I think, I wanted, this whole new dust collection system started because I wanted to do an article on dust collection layout and planning and like performance. Like, here's how you maximize your dust collection in your shop. Here's how you maximize what you have. And here are like the five basic rules. You know, you don't do any hard 90s. You do Y's where you can, stuff like that. So gradual turns, avoid deadheads, you seal everything. And it's that type of stuff. It's like, well, it doesn't really leak that much. Well, yeah, but a lot of little leaks end up being one big leak, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So it's been fun. I mean, I will say, putting up this dust collection stuff sucks. it's not fun.
Well, and that's that's what I was thinking too, is because when you're setting up something like that in your shop, in the shop at Woodsmith, it's all high in the air.
It is.
So it's not super easy to reconfigure and using rigid piping makes things a little bit more permanent too. So you want to be pretty thoughtful about it because changing is a big job.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. Well, as I said, the dust collector's in the corner and the main trunk line comes off at a 45 degree angle. The main trunk line feeds the planer and jointer. That's the very first thing, because that's the highest requirement for air draw. From that, it goes off to the table saw, but the table saw's on the opposite side of my divider wall. So I'm sitting there looking at it like, do I do a little weird jog around? I'm like, that kind of is breaking one of the rules. Like, you don't do that. So I'm like, you know what? I got a chainsaw. I could cut a hole in that wall. So I just punched a giant hole in the wall up top to go through. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's like a permanent thing. You want to think about it. And that's where some of these things, like the drill press, do I really want to run a line clear over here for the drill press that I might not use very often? It's like, well, yeah, but that's actually going to be the closest port to my bench. So if I'm sweeping up shavings, having that sweep there will be really nice.
Yeah, so. it would almost be beneficial if there was a way to have a blast gate to shut down the whole arm.
I know. Yep. I thought about that. You put it like on a little lever, so you open and close it. You know,
like a flue. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. it's exactly what it is. Yeah. So, and you know, I know people will ask, what about PVC dust collection line? It's like, well, there are reasons people use it. There are reasons why the industry says not to use it. So,
yeah, and it's a choice. I think there are several ways. We had some guy write in a tip a number of years ago about going to a carpet store and getting the cardboard tubes that are on the inside of the big rolls of carpet. Cause they're, you know, like 3/8 of an inch thick.
Yeah.
Usually waxed, laminated carpet. And he had used that on his dust collection system. So,
okay.
What he did for fittings, I don't know. But like carpet there's tape.
Yeah. Just cut them into like little sections, like
just miter
sections
them.
And then like tape those all together and
mm-hmm. probably
make a little yeah. turn. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I will say it is really nice having that floor sweep by the lathe too, because I rough turned some wet walnut the other day and I just swept it all right up to an edge straight to the ceiling. It yeah. went away, disappeared. You don't see it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Love it.
Mm-hmm.
Little word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Tightbond. You want a glue that you can trust, and fortunately, Tightbond has the glue you need to get the job done with confidence. From interior glues with strong initial tack and short clamp time to exterior glues with exceptional strength and water resistance, look to Tightbond, the right glue for your next project. For more information, visit tightbond.com. All right, topic number two. I am working on a couple of built-in units for some friends of mine. Mm-hmm. And they're plywood. They're going to be mostly plywood, hardwood face frames, drawer fronts, frame and panel doors, kind of a thing. And the question that I have to pose to both of you is, how would you guys price and have you priced doing stuff like that? You know, because I've done stuff for family where it's like, if you guys do the materials, I'll just help you do it. We'll get yep. this done. And so there's those kind of jobs. And then there's also the ones where, you know, I'm not a professional cabinet maker. So mm-hmm. I don't want to be. That's just a level of crazy that I just, I don't need to add any more crazy to the existing crazy that's in my life. However, there are, that. Yeah. However, there are times when, yeah, I'll build something for somebody because whatever, but I still want to charge a decent price out of it. So yeah.
You got to find that sweet spot where it's like, I don't want to charge too much, but if I charge too little, they're going to ask me to do it a lot. Like yeah. mass for like, oh, that was cheap. Will you do yeah. this? Can you do that? Can you, so it's like, yeah, it's like you want to do people a favor, but also you yeah. value your time.
I mean, there's always, and I feel like we probably hit on this topic like 3 years ago on the podcast.
Yeah.
I always feel like around. You always, yeah, you always feel, or you always hear about like, you know, 2.5 times material cost. It's like, well, yeah, like that might be a good starting base for it.
Right.
But, you know, the thing that I always try to consider is I have a limited amount of time, okay? As we all do. You know, we mm-hmm. have day jobs, second day jobs, and third day jobs. And then we have stuff we have to do outside of work and you know, yada, yada. So if I have a free afternoon, okay, and I'm going to maximize that, let's say, monetarily, okay? The best thing I can do is I can grab the sawmill and I can go mill for somebody. I don't put out posts saying, hey, sawmilling available, yada, yada. I don't do that anymore because I don't have time to do it. But when I do mill for people, $100 an hour is what I charge. So that's kind of my baseline. So it's like if I have 4 hours in an afternoon, and I want to go make some money, I'm going to charge $400 for an afternoon of milling. So if I'm going to spend an afternoon in the shop, that kind of has to be my baseline, right? Mm-hmm. Unless I'm taking it as a discount for a friend. But then that, I mean, that's a different thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I guess I would probably angle that more as a straight commission piece. Like someone's like, hey, I need you to build this table for me. It's like, all right, well, it's going to take me 12 hours to build it, $100 an hour, it's going to be $1,200. And I have the material, so I'm not bothered by that. Now, if it's a friend of mine, you know, we might cut them a break. So might be $50 an hour. But I don't know. I'm married to an accountant, so I get this. Yeah. I get an earful on this all the time.
You have to pay rent.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, it's like you gotta make sure you're keeping track of your hours. I'm like, no, I don't, because I'm doing it when I can.
Well, that's the thing, is because especially if you're doing something kind of on the side, keeping track of your hours is like, that was like 15 minutes that day.
Yeah.
And like 23 minutes that day.
Yeah. I mean, I have done, I don't do commission pieces for random people. So if somebody just emails me and says, hey, I want this. Nope. Not doing it. Sorry.
Right.
I will do things for certain. I will do things for friends. People I've known for years, I will do stuff for.
Yeah.
Most of them want to pay me for what I'm doing.
So right. I will give and this, them what and I that's what the case is here.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. So I'll give them a fair price. So, you know, if it's going to take me, you know, I don't know. Usually they're paying materials. $25 to $35 an hour to me is decent, because it's not, most of us are not paying overhead for our shop. So it's not like we're running a business. If we're running a business, then it's going to have to be $75 to $100 an hour, because right. you have overhead. You have to pay rent. You have to pay insurance. There's depreciation. There's all that. There's consumables,
yeah.
you know, that type of thing. You know, if we're using the shop there, we're not paying that. So, you know, that's where I think you get a little bit of a discount.
Yeah.
John? The best part is when we can double dip and do it as part of our
bingo.
Job. Like, hey, we got to make this project on video, or this is going to be in the magazine now. Or,
yep.
That's where it's at. That's, yep. you know, using your noodle there.
So. Right. Yep. Also forces you to get it done, too.
Right. Yeah. When you're on.
Yeah.
Somebody needs it, and we got to get these videos out.
Yep. Which is almost worse than somebody needing it.
Yeah.
getting the videos out.
Then it's work.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
But I mean, like, I guess to me, saying $100 an hour, that sounds like a lot, right? If I'm going to pay somebody $100 an hour, that seems like a lot. But for myself, like opportunity costs, like there's a lot of stuff I don't want to go do for $100 an hour.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like if I had a buddy that was like, hey, you want to come help me do tree work for 3 hours? I'll give you $100 an hour. I'm like, nope, it's 95 degrees out. I do not. Yeah. I do not want the $300. Thank you. So, but I guess, you know, when you start, you know, all things considered, I would put that as an entire all-in price for shops, supplies, not materials, but shop supplies, you know, router bit usage, blade usage. I mean, because all that stuff has to come into play. You're not buying a $150 saw blade for nothing, you know?
Yeah, and the time and gas it takes to get materials and all that stuff. I mean, it's not all shop time. There's... you know, lots of other stuff too. So
we are not businessmen, and there are reasons.
No,
there are reasons why we're not businessmen.
We are bankrupt.
Uh-huh. Broke as a joke.
Yeah. Right.
Well, that's why we're not in the real world.
That's right.
Well, and that's the other thing too, is to be very mindful of what, you know, the fuzzy line of what materials are, because it's not just the plywood and the hardwood. It's the drawer slides and pulls and biscuits to assemble plywood cases and screws for all that stuff. And
the type on glue.
And the, well.
I mean, it's the most trusted glue. And I don't know. Whatever the bit is.
That was smooth, right. John.
Yeah, that was seamless. Yeah.
Now here's the question though. Okay. So there are a few people that I have done stuff at no charge for. There's a few people I've done. I like to do trades though. That's what I really like to do. It's like, hey, you know, I know you got a couple of nice 12 gauges that you're not using. You don't duck hunt anymore. I'll build you that table for those, or, you know, whatever. I like doing some barter and horse trading and stuff.
Yeah.
If you donated it, donated your time, can you write that off on taxes?
Depends who you're donating it to, probably.
Does it?
Yeah, it does.
Like, do they have a 501c or?
I guess that would have to be. Yeah, that's fair. I can't just donate John time.
Yeah, let's just donate it off of my taxes. Back and forth. You know?
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll get it. Yeah, we'll get our tax liability down to zero.
Yeah, right.
It's gonna be great.
We got it figured out. We're not going to jail or nothing.
No.
Because we don't have any record of this at all.
My phone was listening anyways.
Yeah. Okay. Well, like I said, it's I don't do it for a lot of people.
Yep.
But I'm not doing it for nothing.
Correct.
You know, I'm doing it to make some extra money, but it's also not a... Yeah.
Well, and that's... See, most of the time what I end up doing is saying, look, here's the material price, okay? Now, if it's my stuff I've sawn, then I'm making money on the material, right? I mean, that I'm going to make money on the material anyways, whether I build this project or not. I'm going to sell it to somebody else, okay?
Yeah.
But, you know, here's the price of the material. Knowing that up front, here's how long I think it's going to take me, 20 hours, okay? I will keep track of my time, and then I'll tell you how much time I had into it, and then you pay me what you think my time's worth. And then you figure out how much they value you.
There you go.
There you go.
You got them.
Yep. All right. Okay, final thing to talk about today is a TV show project is a Limbert bookcase.
Yep.
That was featured in Popular Woodworking.
Yep.
Done by, and now his name has totally escaped me.
Willie Sandry.
That's who I was exactly thinking of.
Yep. That's, yep.
And it's a pretty cool piece because a lot of arts and crafts pieces can feel pretty square.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
it has a little shapely waist on it.
Mm-hmm. Right. They also can be a little hulking in size. Mm-hmm. And this one is it's probably like 5 feet tall altogether.
Case, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, yeah. So I like it. And we're using some bur oak from you.
Mm-hmm.
And John and I made some alternate construction decisions.
Okay.
Yesterday and today. So.
Okay. Well,
so it's a pretty cool piece, but when you're just kind of doing it on the fly, you're going to run into stuff where it's like, if you make this change, it theoretically makes something a little bit easier, but there's some downstream stuff that you have to make sure you're accounting for. So for example, there are two basically side assemblies.
Yep.
Front and back leg connected to a solid wood panel, like a post and panel construction. Mm-hmm. Willie used biscuits on that. Great choice there. At the front are two rails that form kind of a face frame with the front legs. He used mortise and tenon. We decided to go pocket screw on it just to simplify it.
Okay.
That was very judgmental.
It was meant to be.
Yeah. It's what Limbert would have wanted.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it totally is. Yeah.
Hmm.
And then the bottom, the case bottom, he has it resting in dados cut into the side panels. Mm-hmm. So we're just using biscuits instead. Again, I feel like that's a pretty even trade on that.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah. It's going to come together.
It's going to come together.
Okay. Oh, Lord.
I'm just telling you, I'm not trying to explain it or defend it. Yeah. So.
Oh, we know. Oh, this bastardized project is brought to you by Chunk-a-Trunk.
Putting the case bottom in a full width dado or with biscuits.
Yeah. Tomato, tomato.
I mean, it's as small as this bookcase, it's not going to carry a lot of weight at any point. I mean, it's
and it's like not a dynamic
wide. Or whatever. So it's like,
yeah, it's not, I would say, yeah, the top itself was only like 26 or 30. Wasn't
I mean, at the widest point, it's like 2 feet wide. So it's not going to carry a lot of weight. There's a lot of, you know, joinery. I mean, not joinery, but there's a lot of, it's stout.
Like a screw joinery.
Yeah, it's stout for its size.
Yeah.
So it's not going to carry a lot of weight. It's, so, I'm checking off on it.
Here's,
as an engineer.
Yeah, we have someone signed off on it, so we're good. Yeah.
God, my soul just died a little bit. So here's the thing that I think I really enjoy, and I know it's a pain in the ass, and I was thinking about this while old John and I were breaking parts down a couple days ago. Working with rough sound stuff is definitely more work.
Oh, yeah.
Especially stuff from a small operation like myself. Like if it's rough sound stock that a big mill's doing, cool. They have the processes in place to clean it up before it ever hits somebody's shop, right? But like working with rough sound stock, I love it because it's like you figure out how to get parts out, where you get parts out. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm digging through a freaking one stall garage full of white oak trying to figure out what actually has some flake figure because Baroque doesn't have a ton of it. So I'm trying to pick out good parts, you know. And I'm doing the same thing today with cherry. Like this big slab of cherry, I'm breaking apart these pieces for this little splay leg table. It's like, okay, I could put this knot on the lower half of this leg because I know the taper is going to cut it off. Like, I love that. Like, it is a pain in the butt. But I guess you got to decide whether the added or the cost savings by having roughs on stock versus, you know, even skip plane stock, you know, if we buy skip plane stock from Liberty, they charge 65 cents a board foot to skip plane it. So, you know, at that point, you're getting stuff that's a little bit flatter and you can see the grain is the biggest thing. So,
I almost prefer getting like big, thick, rough sawn pieces and bringing it down because you can resaw stuff to thickness and you usually have stuff that matches that way. And it's fun kind of picking through it and strategizing for parts.
Yeah, I will definitely agree on that because I think, and I think that's where John and I are kind of bumping into it in the construction here is that we're trying to make those decisions with the material that you have.
Yeah.
But in trying to do it, and this is do it in a timely way for filming.
Yeah.
So those two things kind of are at odds with each other, you know, when we're trying to make the most of everyone's time down here. And it's not something that very many people deal with, but it's one of those things where it's a task that the three of us do in building a project all the time that you almost don't think about it until there's kind of a time constraint. And then you realize, oh, all of these little things add up to a half an hour later. Now we're ready for the next block.
Yep. Yeah.
So like I said, it's not any big deal. It's just, was just one of those things where it was more of a curiosity for how a project gets built. It's just one of those, like you said, it's a really enjoyable part of the process.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to me because I always, when I'm selling lumber to somebody, a lot of the times I'm very, very conservative when I measure it. So if somebody comes to me and says, hey, I need 100 board feet of walnut, they're probably getting close to 200 board feet. Because I'm like taking out like, okay, there's a foot there that has a knot in it. They're probably not going to use, even though most of us are like, we know what it is. I mean, it is what it is, right?
Right.
Like you're paying for that no matter what. Like it's a natural product. If that walnut tree or that oak tree was completely clear and clean, it's a veneer log. It's not a saw log. Saw logs have knots. They have, you know, mineral streaks. They have that type of stuff. It's funny because this one in particular, you know, I was trying to find oak that had fleck in it. I have a ton of, I wouldn't call it clear, but I have a ton of stuff that just doesn't have figure. Like I have a lot of riffs on stuff that's completely clean.
Yeah.
But for the arts and crafts style look, you know,
You kind of want that.
You want the big fleck. And Baroque's not necessarily known for that. So
no, I mean, there's some pieces on there, like the two pieces that we have for the rails have a lot of fleck. The front legs that we ended up choosing.
Yep.
You know, John had, well, I think you and John did the glue up on the leg blanks.
Yep.
And then John jointed and planed it. And then we were, I mean, I think it was what, like 15 minutes or so as we were just kind of looking at the different arrangements, like these are the front two legs, but is it this face or this face? Mm-hmm. And then if we do that, should it be, this is the right leg and this is the left leg or the other way or.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And there's a knot here, but if we cut the taper there, will we that knot out or are we making it? Are we just opening up a big knot on the side
and
of the...
And sometimes you don't know.
Yeah.
Well, and it's like, I had a couple of panels for the sides on that, and John and I were looking at them. It's like, these have some flake in them. They look good, but they're what I would call rustic great oak, which I think that we should just change the name from Baroque to rustic oak.
There we go.
Completely. Mm-hmm. But John's like, John and I were looking at it. It's like, okay, those would work fine if everything was like that.
Right.
You know what I mean? But like I had a giant thick piece of Baroque that and the top, the corbels and those front rails all came out of with pretty good figure in all of those. And it's just one of those things that it's like, you know, I don't know. Those were clean, so it's like you don't mix in the rustic with the clean, nice-looking stuff. It's either all dirty and dingy or none of it's dirty and dingy.
Yeah.
The inside can be. The inside, I mean, like that bottom shelf and the adjustable shelf, those can be whatever they are. You know, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and that's what we had is the case bottom has a bunch of, like, pin knots in it from being glued up.
Yep.
But it's the case bottom. You know, there's going to be something in the case all the time, you know. Yeah. So, and then one of the side panels just had a low spot from sawing or whatever. So when John was thicknessing them, it's like this panel is either going to be super clear and consistent thickness at about 9/16 or we leave 90% of it at 3/4. And then there's just this little section. Well, we cut it. John cut it in a way that it ends up being below the case bottom side on the inside face. Nobody ever going to see that. So it's like,
And
you know, making the most of your parts.
Oh yeah. Well, and it's like, I know the top panels, the two top panels I cut, there was one corner of one of them that was getting really thin. So it's like, okay, we can still maintain the thickness if we align these two faces and plane off on this side. You know, it's like, I love that game. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people don't, but those are the people that also just end up paying more for material.
Right.
Yeah. And it's then you end up.
Discovery.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Sometimes it doesn't work out, but, you know, shoot your shot.
But then that means you're also burning a lot of material, too.
Yeah.
You are, yes.
You know, like you're just, you've jointed and planed and resawed a bunch of firewood.
Yeah. Which, and there's definitely some, you know, there's definitely some of that. Like, I'm not going to turn around my camera because the shop's crazy right now. But, like, I have a ton of, like, ash and cherry that is just in a big pile right now. It's firewood. And that's fine. Like, that's perfectly acceptable use for it.
Yeah.
So, it's not something that anybody would use. Or... some people would hoard it maybe, and then they would never use it.
There you go. All right. I think that wraps up another episode of the Shop Notes podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or smart remarks about the stuff that we've been talking about today, I want to hear about it. You can put it in the comment section on our YouTube channel. You can also send us an email, woodsmith@woodsmith.com. Just put something in the subject line about being in relation to the podcast. Thanks again to Tight Bond Glue for sponsoring the podcast this month. Tight Bond has been the glue of choice in the shop at Woodsmith for practically its entire, well, pretty much its entire history, 45 years. And there's a reason for it. They do great products and they have a wide range of applications from speed set glue, which we use on the TV studio when things got to get done, to the panel glue ups that we did yesterday with liquid hide glue, which is perfect for working with white oak. So you want to check that out at tightbond.com. And we'll see you next week, everybody. Bye.